notoriously stormy lakes of large size that lay toward the end of the Thelon's course that I'd have to get through. On August 25th, I put in a 13-hour day of paddling, passing many sandy beaches and one giant island, all while battling headwinds and sidewinds. In the afternoon, the wind shifted in my favor, and for one glorious hour, I actually sailed, flying along at great speed. The wind soon shifted, though, and back I went to paddling. But the sail had certainly cheered me. But what really excited me was approaching a bend and seeing a lone wolf standing sentinel on a ridge, apparently keeping a watchful eye on me as I paddled along below. This wolf had a creamy, blondish-white coat, differing from the purer white ones I'd become accustomed to seeing. This wolf also seemed more alert and watchful, as if it had encountered humans before. This was probable, since in midsummer the Thelon attracts parties of canoeists, who normally get dropped by float planes somewhere on its upper reaches. In late summer, with the fierce winds and shorter days, few chance paddling it. As I finished rounding the bend, I saw why the wolf had been keeping an eye out. Down below on the willow-covered bank stood four little wolf pups, their mother a few feet away. They all had the same creamy blonde fur as the wolf up on the ridge. When the pups saw me, they immediately scattered, diving into some willows. The pups' reaction had been so swift that it seemed rehearsed, as if their parents had trained them in exactly what to do on any hint of danger. Her mother, meanwhile, was very brave. She came right down to the shore and growled in my direction. I wish I could have told them they had nothing to fear from me. Then she tipped her head back and howled. This brought her mate down from the ridge. The whole performance filled me with awe. I admired how brave and devoted they seemed, putting themselves squarely between the hidden pups and me. As I continued drifting downstream on the current, the female wolf actually followed me along the bank, keeping an eye on me, while the father remained with the pups. But then, one of the pups squirmed out of the willows and came right out into the open on shore, looking at me curiously as I drifted away. Whatever happened in the miles that still lay ahead, fierce winds that might strand me for weeks, swamping in frigid rapids, winter closing in before I could reach the finish line, seemed but a small matter to have seen wolves up close in the wild. Watching that family of wolves had felt almost magical, an experience I knew I would always cherish. It's the kind of thing that I hope remains possible in a world that leaves fewer and fewer wild places for wolves to roam. At camp that night, I tallied up the day's sightings. A moose, a caribou, two eagles, six wolves, a red fox, a dozen tundra swans, and no humans. That's what I think anyone would agree is a successful day. To cap it off, I paddled for 13 hours and slept on a beach overlooking the river. The nights were growing darker, with the sun completely disappearing for 4 or 5 hours below the horizon. Signs of the changing season were now everywhere. As I paddled my lonely way downriver, flocks of snow geese passed overhead, heading south. The scenery had continued to change too, with great hills splashed with red, gold, and green as the autumn transformed the land into a colorful quilt. But by afternoon, the skies had turned dark and dismal, altering the mood of the landscape. With its high ridges and rocky shores, it now seemed a dreary place. The river here was only about 300 meters wide and enclosed by high gravel banks. Ahead, I could hear the roar of white water. Paddling through the rain, I approached the start of the white water in my canoe. They were deep rapids, free of visible rocks, but with big standing waves that could easily swamp a canoe. Naturally, I decided to canoe right through them. By this point, I had a pretty fair idea of what the boat and I could handle. I allowed the main current to suck us down the center toward the towering white-capped waves. With my paddle, I steered into them. The canoe rode over the crest of the first wave, becoming almost vertical as the bow soared into the open air. Then we plunged into the next wave, throwing frigid water in my face. I exhaled at the shock. There's nothing like a bucket of ice-cold water smack in the face to wake you up. It was an exhilarating roller coaster ride through these big rapids, the canoe flying up and down as I steered and paddled, with one eye on what lay immediately in front of me, and the other on the best course farther ahead. When I'd passed through the last of the big waves, I glanced down and saw that my knees were submerged. A considerable amount of water had accumulated inside the canoe from the wild run. A pack of matches sat bobbing in the canoe. Fortunately, I had extras. I pivoted towards shore and paddled into a rocky area to unpack everything. Canoes can hold quite a lot of water before they sink, as I knew from past experience fooling around with them in rapids or big waves. Still, I figured it was prudent to dump out the water before continuing, especially since I knew I was nearing the Thelon's dreaded giant lakes. These windswept lakes form a chain more than 200 kilometers long. They're known for their treacherous winds and waves. Most parties of canoeists who descend the Thelon opt to arrange a pickup at the start of the lakes by float plane or even motorboat shuttle in order to avoid crossing them. Crossing them solo, late in the season with cold temperatures, shorter days, and violent winds, is one of those things in life that many people will tell you are best avoided. That 1970s-era report I'd photocopied had warned about the dangers of these lakes, noting that even in midsummer, gale-force winds were common. Of course, it was now well beyond midsummer, so I didn't have to worry about those midsummer gales. Instead, I could look forward to the larger gales of September. The report had also warned about the complex web of islands and channels that connects each of the big lakes, and how easy it is to get turned around in these mazes. I reached the first of the lakes shortly after passing through the big rapids. This part of my route was also the one I'd studied the least beforehand, devoting most of my memory space to the labyrinthine complexity of the many dozens of lakes in the central portion of my journey. Plus, I figured, if I did make it this far, the thousands of kilometers of traveling up to this point would have prepared me to work things out once I got here. As it happened, at the point where I thought I was almost at the first of the big lakes, known as Beverly Lake, the maps on the GPS indicated that the channel I intended to follow was a dead end. This gave me a moment's pause as I drifted on the current, seated in my canoe, staring at the map. Somehow, I thought the map looked wrong. Although it claimed this was a dead end, the perceptible current suggested otherwise. I took the shoreline to be not a peninsula, but rather a large sandy island. I decided to stick with my gut rather than the maps, and chose to paddle down the allegedly dead-end bay. 4 kilometers of paddling later, it was with relief that I came round a bend and saw a vast expanse of frigid water riddled with white caps stretching off to the horizon. It had been the correct channel after all. The map was wrong. It might seem surprising that 21st century maps can still have errors on them, but it's more common than supposed. Not only do sandy channels appear and disappear with the shifting currents and ice melts, but even today, human error and educated guesses remain part of the map-making process, especially in a place as immense as Canada's north. Now, all I had to do was get across the lake. The wind was blowing hard to the north, so I decided to follow the lake's rock-strewn south shore. It didn't offer much protection from the wind, but it was a shorter overall distance, and with dark skies above, I wasn't sure how far I could make it before conditions ruled out further travel on safety grounds. Given the weather, it was critical that I stay close to shore now. Risking any kind of big water crossing was dangerous. About 20 kilometers of hard paddling brought me to a great peninsula, beyond which lay a collection of windswept islands. The winds had shifted as I neared the peninsula. To round it promised to be tricky, as I'd have to paddle broadside to the large waves that were crashing into its shore. I debated whether to attempt it now or gamble on better winds come morning. What swayed my decision was the sight of thunderclouds massing on the horizon. The high winds would move those clouds quickly in my direction. With the fierce winds and coming storm, I needed to make camp. The peninsula would have to wait for morning. The land sloped up from the lake to level tundra, which seemed aflame with bright red colors that had transformed the leaves of the Arctic berries. Among these were dashes of orange and yellow scattered about where the little clumps of dwarf birch had turned out their fall suits. It was all wonderfully beautiful, although the massive storm gathering on the horizon somewhat diverted me from pausing too long to admire it. The good news was the presence of some rocky hills nearby. Any bolts of lightning, I hoped, would strike these and not my tent poles. However, for once, the billowing winds turned out to be friendly, and to my great relief, they blew the thunderstorm right past my tent, narrowly missing me. I watched it drift rapidly by over the lake. Rain and winds remained, but these I could handle as I huddled inside my tent for the night, warm and dry. I woke to the tent shaking in high winds and heavy rain. I shivered in the cold as I sat up. I'd taken to sleeping in my warm jacket again, with the hood zipped up. I peeked out through the door. The lake looked angry, with whitecaps ravaging it. "Well," I said to the tent, "I guess we'll just sleep a bit longer until this blows over." That didn't pan out the way I'd hoped. An hour later, the rain had only turned heavier and the wind stronger. The combination of the two allowed water to start pooling inside my tent. So I packed everything up and just crouched near the door, staring at the storm, waiting for any break. I grew anxious about my prospects. I thought of those accounts of canoeists stranded for weeks. Time was critical, but there was no way the peninsula could be rounded in such fierce winds and stormy weather. So I decided to set off on foot and scout things out, to see if I could formulate some alternate plan. A kilometer hike brought me across the hilly peninsula to the far side. The wind was still fierce here, but the lake wasn't nearly as exposed, and so the waves weren't as much of a factor. I concluded that if I could portage everything here, I'd be able to continue paddling into the narrow maze leading to the next body of water, Aberdeen Lake. At this point, I'd hoped that all my portaging would be behind me, but with fall canoeing in the Arctic, I had to accept such unconventional approaches to things as the only way I was ever going to reach Baker Lake before winter. Back at camp, my tent was getting drenched. I packed it up in the rain and wind. There was no denying how miserable it was trekking with my first load for nearly a kilometer across steep, hilly terrain, and then down into a swampy valley. My hiking boots were quickly soaked right through. With cold, wet feet, I returned to fetch my next load. Fortunately, on the way back, I did find some cloudberries. Transporting all the loads, up the steep hills and across willow thickets and swampy lowlands to the lakeshore, was a little exhausting. But I felt confident my plan would work. Fierce as the gusts were, bypassing the open part of the lake should enable me to continue. When I had everything across, I ate 2 energy bars, switched out of my drenched boots and socks into some dry ones in my waders, then set off, paddling hard. The wind was brutally fierce, but if I could overcome it for just a short distance, I'd be able to escape into the maze of islands, which would shelter me from the waves. That island maze snaked for over 42 kilometers before reaching Aberdeen Lake. Finally, once inside the islands, I found I could mostly paddle, except in those places where the twisting, confusing channels faced into the wind. Here, the powerful gusts proved too much. Then, I had no choice but to set my paddle aside, step overboard into the shallows near shore, and drag the canoe with rope. The navigating here was among the most challenging I'd encountered anywhere on my journey. The islands all kind of blended into each other, concealing passageways between them. To find my way, I relied as much on detecting the current as I did on reading my maps. Yet when the wind gusted, the current could be hard to detect. I once found myself heading down a side channel, only to discover that the headwinds had hidden the flow's real direction. I'd almost gone up a false passage, one that would have taken me into the mouth of an altogether different river, the Dubond. However, when I saw the current clearly, I realized my mistake and paddled back to the far shore, finding the right passage. In the midst of all this wading and dragging, I felt my left wader suddenly filling with freezing water. The spruce gum patch had punctured. There wasn't anything I could do about it at the moment. No spruce trees were anywhere near here, so I ignored it and kept going. At least my other foot was still dry. That lasted about 20 minutes. Then my right wader sprang a leak and flooded. This was harder to ignore, but I chalked it up to one of those days we all sometimes suffer. You know the sort, when nothing seems to go in your favor. It was just one of those days. My progress against the bitter winds was painfully slow, and by the time I set up camp that evening, I'd made it only about halfway through the island maze. I had to stop a bit early in order to take care of my gear. With both sets of my footwear, the hiking boots and waders, now soaked, I was in a dreaded predicament I'd so far avoided on my journey. My cargo pants and tent were also wet from wading and the rain. Further complicating matters were the nightly temperatures that were starting to drop down to freezing. To take care of things, I pitched my drenched tent without the fly, letting the wind rush through it to dry it out. My pants I strung up on a paddle, and my hiking boots I placed on the overturned canoe to dry as best they could. I also had, as a sort of backup measure, baby powder in my first aid kit. I sprinkled it in my hiking boots to help absorb the moisture. Whether it'd work or not, I didn't know, but just now, I wanted to believe it might. The more difficult question was how to get the waders dry. The best I could do was prop them up with rocks and let the wind inflate them. This worked tolerably well. Fortunately, stashed away in my backpack was a secret weapon I'd been saving. A pair of $80 waterproof Gore-Tex socks. These magical things I'd owned for years and had never used, judging it wise to save them for when it really counted. The rough days ahead, I had a strong feeling, were going to be that time. Chapter 20, The Storms of September. Frost blanketing my tent greeted me the next morning. Those terrible words, "Winter is coming," were in my head again. Ahead of me, beyond the island maze, lay the frightening expanse of Aberdeen Lake, over 70 kilometers of open water to paddle across in what were likely to be big waves and fierce winds. I began by pulling on dry wool socks, then putting the Gore-Tex socks over them as an outer layer to keep them dry. Next, I strapped on my hip waders, which were still damp in the boots, although with my magic socks, that didn't matter. I wore three layers to protect me from the cold winds: my warm wool blend base layer, my fleece sweater and cargo pants, and finally my outer rain pants, warm waterproof jacket, toque, and gloves. With the canoe repacked, I pushed off. Stiff headwinds slowed me through the remainder of the maze. It took me 4 hours to reach the vast expanse of Aberdeen Lake. I found it a rather bleak and desolate-looking place, with stony shores filled with dark gray boulders and smaller rocks. It reminded me of the islands in the high Arctic, where my friend Travis and I had canoed together. Looking out across the waves, I sure wished I could have had Travis with me now. Facing these waves, a strong paddler in the bow would make all the difference. I made a mental note of this for the purpose of future trips. My plan was to hug the north shore. This might possibly expose me to more winds and waves, as well as many bays, but the south shore had its own share of bays, and more critically, two gigantic peninsulas jutting far into the lake. Taking the south shore would therefore demand a lot more paddling just to get around those great peninsulas. So, for better or worse, I chose the north shore. With the wind chill, it was below freezing. I kept warm by paddling hard, riding over whitecaps, following the bleak shore. Some ways up lay a chain of islands. I drove myself on with the thought that they'd at least offer some respite from the wrath of the open lake. Wave after wave, my canoe glided over, rising and crashing. In the fierce winds, my canoe at times seemed to barely move forward at all. I'd have to pick a point on shore, a jagged boulder or pile of rocks, and keep my eyes on it to reassure myself that I was still moving forward. By early evening, I'd reached the islands. Things here weren't much easier, since the winds were still howling, but at least within their sheltered reaches, the waves weren't dangerous. I camped on shore near the end of the island chain and at the start of a wide estuary. Some river I didn't know was draining into the lake here, creating mud flats extending far out into the water. Crossing seemed difficult, but that was a problem for the morning. In the meantime, I made camp as the sun sank below the horizon. With the nights growing steadily longer, I no longer had the tactic in my arsenal that I'd used on Great Bear of paddling by night and sleeping during the day to avoid the winds. To cross the estuary, a strenuous portage was necessary, as I couldn't drag my heavily loaded canoe across it, nor could I avoid it without paddling back some way around islands. It was a slow start to the day, sweating as I sunk into the wet clay, hauling everything a kilometer to water deep enough to paddle. On the bright side, it let me stretch my legs before getting into the canoe. Once I was across it, I was back on the lake facing waves. For safety, I kept as close to shore as I could, but too close, and the surf was a little much. Frequently, there were considerable bays along the north shore. Some of these I chanced cutting across. It was a little bit dicey, given the waves were generally massive. I rode over whitecaps while paddling as fast as my arms would allow. What gave me the most worry was that a sudden uptick in the winds might catch me far offshore, in the middle of a bay. The hardest parts were rounding rocky points, where I was most exposed to the wind. I managed to cover 50 kilometers over 13 hours of paddling. When I finally stopped for the night, I felt grateful to be back on dry land, even that desolate shoreline. After months of daylight, it was a little strange to see sunsets in real darkness again. The night seemed darker than ever as I sat alone on the stony shore, watching the last glow of red dip below the horizon. Without the midnight sun and the singing and chirping of the little shorebirds, things felt pretty lonely. The following morning dawned almost calm, allowing me to escape from Aberdeen Lake. I soon passed into the smaller narrows leading to the third and final expanse of Big Water. Navigating these relative narrows could be difficult, given the low shorelines of gravel and rock that blended into the hills and high ridges lying back from the water. They'd be even more difficult to navigate for the majority of the year when everything was blanketed under snow and ice, the time when traditionally most Arctic traveling was done. But what told me I was on the right track was the sight of ghostly rock cairns overlooking the far shore. These were Inuksuks, real Inuksuks, ancient stone pillars pointing the way. I knew they were centuries old at least. Unlike the stereotypical southern Inuksuk that has proliferated beyond all bounds over recent decades, these real ones didn't have arms and were composed of hundreds of small, carefully stacked rocks, as opposed to giant boulders. It was obvious that considerable labor had been required to create them. It was another 41 kilometers of paddling through smaller lakes and channels before I reached that last big expanse of water. Halfway through, though, a gale rapidly materialized and pinned me on shore. These were the strongest winds I'd seen yet, rendering any kind of traveling impossible. It forced me to make camp early above a pebbly beach. My tent I carefully angled into the wind, securing it with extra guy lines and rocks piled on top of the pegs. The fierce winds did let me dry out some gear that had become wet from waves splashing into me. My clothing I spread out on the ground and pinned down with rocks. While letting everything dry, I found some crowberries to snack on. Since there was little else I could do, I decided to call it an early night. But just as I was about to crawl into my tent, which was shaking rather violently in the wind, I spotted in the far distance specks moving inland along the horizon. Climbing a small hill for a better view, I saw it was a musk ox herd. I counted about 20 of them, moving at a surprisingly fast pace. This made me a little anxious. I hoped they didn't come in my direction. If I could, I would have repacked my canoe and moved on to get away, but the gale kept me trapped where I was. On the other hand, there wasn't anywhere I could go that muskox couldn't go to. I watched the herd until it disappeared among the hills, reassuring myself that the muskox had been heading away from me. The only other wildlife about were flocks of snow geese that seemed to congregate in the narrows, but these didn't frighten me all that much. The next day, I was up at 4 a.m. to take advantage of whatever morning calm I could. 3 hours of hard paddling brought me through some smaller lakes, and then to a swift-flowing channel, where a great bald eagle was perched on a boulder hunting fish. I zoomed along as rapidly as I could, admiring the eagle's enormous wingspan as it took off toward the penultimate lake of my journey. A frightful expanse of frigid water that stretched beyond the horizon under gray skies. I took the north shore again. It had served me well across Aberdeen Lake, and I hoped for a repeat of that success. Across these new dark waters rose a mountain shaped like a giant tidal wave, a tsunami frozen in stone. High slate-gray ridges and stupendous rock outcrops, ancient beyond conception, marked the distant shore of a bay I'd have to round. Closer in, lining the near shore I intended to follow, were dark cliffs, boulders, and stony beaches. A mere 7,000 years ago, none of this land would have been visible. It was all at the bottom of the ocean, aside from the mountain summits, which just crested the salt water as bleak little islands. Melting glaciers had at that time caused sea levels to rise, creating a vastly enlarged Hudson Bay, known as the Tyrell Sea. As I paddled under the unbroken gray skies through the remnants of this lost world, it looked like a desolate moonscape of rock and gravel, with hardly any hint of living things, no grasses, willows, or other vegetation. In places, my curiosity about the rocks was such that I couldn't resist going ashore to inspect them. Some were hundreds of millions of years old, ancient Precambrian rocks blasted by unknown eons and exposed in their present state during the last ice age. A little farther along, a flock of snow geese passed in front of some gray mountains. Against the cliffs in the haze, they looked almost like something prehistoric. I couldn't see across the lake, the distance was too far, but large swells were rolling in from the south. Fortunately, my canoe rode over these without trouble. I kept paddling steadily, keeping my eyes fixed on the barren ridges towering in the distance. Some hours later, I was surprised at the sight of a deserted fishing camp. Beneath gray cliffs stood a handful of ramshackle, collapsing structures of rotting plywood and weathered timbers. The wind had largely died, leaving a strange calm hanging over the land. The only sounds were the lapping of swells coming in from across the lake. Amid the desolation of the gravel and rocks, the decaying structures assumed a rather eerie air. By the close of the day, I'd reached midway down a giant, rocky headland, nearly cutting the lake in two. The skies had stayed overcast all day, and now they looked increasingly stormy. The stony shoreline offered few appealing places to sleep, and the sight of three musk ox grazing higher up on some grassy hills induced me to push on a little farther. At last, under a light rain, I halted to make camp on a decent enough spit of sand and gravel. I had to haul my gear a ways inland to reach it, but once everything was set up, it felt comfortable enough for one night. Cracks of thunder jarred me awake. A lightning flash illuminated the inside of my tent. I counted the seconds until the next burst. The storm was somewhere to the north, but a little too close for comfort. Another flash of lightning lit up the sky. It seemed the mountains north of me had been struck. I crouched to minimize the amount of my body touching the ground, which I always did when camped in lightning storms. That way, if you do get struck, less of your body will be grounded, and your survival chances will be better. Eventually, the sky's fury passed away, and I lay back down to sleep. By 4 a.m., I was awake again, my internal clock telling me it was time I was paddling. The morning calm was when I made my best distances, and I needed to take full advantage of it. It was September now, so I couldn't afford to miss it. My task was to round the remainder of the giant headland I'd camped on. The end of this point, jutting far into the lake, promised to be a stormy, dangerous place. Paddling up the rest of the headland, I sometimes cut across smaller bays, saving me time from hugging the shoreline. Crossing one of these bays, I saw specks in the distance moving along the opposite shore. As I neared, I began counting them. Over 30 musk ox. I gave myself a break on the relative calm to drift in and watch the herd. At one point, a big bull, with giant horns, galloped at a smaller one, driving it off. This performance, the large bull repeated several times, giving me unpleasant sensations about what it might be like to be on the receiving end of one of those charges. As I drifted a little closer, the bull came toward the water and snorted at me, though I was in too deep water to have anything to fear. Well, anything to fear from muskox. An hour of hard paddling later, and I made it around the point. The winds had increased steadily, which made paddling exhausting, but fortunately, the waves weren't too big. Still, once I rounded the point, I had no choice but to make a long detour back up along its opposite side to a place where I could safely cross over to the lake's eastern shores. In perfectly calm weather, I'd have chanced crossing the open water to where I needed to get to, but not in the high winds of September. The detour was a long one, but I was rewarded by the sight of some graceful, long-tailed jaegers flying by. They're striking white and black seabirds with long tail feathers that dangle behind them, like streamers on a kite, as they soar across the water, hunting fish. The jaegers weren't the only animals moving over the windswept shores. With excitement, I spotted a family of three caribou, two adults and a young calf, trotting along on a ridge. On those rocks grow hardy lichens that the caribou feed on. The wind had continued to increase, but once I'd traced the headland up to a point where it was only a kilometer across to the lake's eastern shore, I figured I could safely manage the crossing. The wind was blowing from the east, which meant I'd have to paddle into a headwind the whole way, so I rested a while to gather up my energy. In the middle of the crossing, I'd be about a half kilometer from the nearest land. This wasn't much compared to the bigger crossings I'd done earlier, but in the stiff winds, it sure felt like more. Hard strokes brought me across the bay to the far shore, where I found the most chaotic jumble of boulders I'd ever seen. Boulders and rocks beyond counting smothered every inch of shoreline, extending up a low ridge far inland, leaving not a speck of soil anywhere for so much as an Arctic willow to grow on. This went on for kilometers, a wasteland of rocks that looked impossible to even walk across without twisting both ankles. But nearly everything has an upside, and the raised, rocky shore helped shelter me from the increasing winds. When I reached the end of the bay, I had to turn into the headwinds, which had grown almost impossibly strong. At times, my furious paddling did nothing but hold me in a standstill, like a hamster on a treadmill. I would have camped, but the shoreline remained an endless rocky waste, with nowhere to stake down a tent. So I pushed on, using up the last of my strength to cross another, mercifully smaller bay. The winds were howling now. I needed to find somewhere soon to put in before conditions turned any worse. A little farther on was a small bit of tundra grass amid the boulders. I headed for it. Under ordinary circumstances, it probably wasn't what most people would call an enticing campsite, but after kilometers of exposed rocks, to me, it looked like a patch of paradise. I made camp quickly, securing my tent with extra guy lines to hold it against the gales. Across the lake were beautiful mountains sloping up gracefully to exposed summits, their lower flanks a blaze of fall colors. With the tent up and time on my hands, I decided to hike inland to scout things out. There turned out to be nothing but ancient windswept rocks, so I figured I'd better head back before the weather turned any more severe. My ultimate fear was a wind gust would catch my canoe and carry it into the lake while I was gone, or waking up in the morning to discover that it had vanished in the night on a gust. I'd heard of this happening once to an unfortunate party of campers, though there were 8 of them, so they could divide the 2 who'd lost their canoe between the 3 other boats. Fortunately, my canoe sat overturned just where I'd left it. But the sight of the damage to its hull, especially a big patch wearing alarmingly thin, wasn't very comforting. Ahead of me still lay dangerous rapids where hitting a rock could puncture the canoe and spill me into the icy, turbulent water. I knew that these very rapids had drowned past travelers. I piled some rocks on my canoe to help secure it in the winds and stashed my other gear underneath it. Meanwhile, my tent was shaking, the poles nearly buckling from the force of the winds pounding down on the tent's sides. The gusts were freezing, and to keep my gloved hands warm, I waved them about. I felt better after I'd boiled water in the shelter of some boulders, making hot tea and a freeze-dried meal. Tea really can make any scenario better. The winds remained fierce all night, and this time the dawn brought no relief. With dismay, I stood on the rocky point and looked across the stormy waters at the whitecaps. A flock of snow geese passed overhead, apparently heading south for warmer climes. All day the wind raged, fierce and cold, without a single break. Unlike earlier, here, given the rough shorelines and the strength of the winds, it wasn't possible for me to press on by wading and dragging the canoe with rope. All I could do was wait. Lying in my tent that night, I thought I heard sandhill cranes making their eerie calls in the dark. Of all birds, it's the cranes' strange-sounding calls that have the greatest documented range, remaining audible for miles away. The sound of these calls echoing across the windy and forlorn, darkened landscape was really quite something. But I couldn't be sure if I heard them at all, or if it was merely some trick of the wind. Chapter 21, Journey's End. Come morning, the wind still wasn't any better. Indeed, it seemed worse. I'd been stranded for 2 days now on that rocky point, with no apparent escape. After hours of idleness, I decided to set out on another hike. Only a calm spell could help me now, but anything was better than sitting idle. I promised my canoe and tent I'd be back in a few hours, then set off northeast to see whether I could spot where the Thelon River reemerges from the lake. As I strode on, I admired, in spite of the wind and desolate rocks, the beauty of the Arctic in fall. Across the water were alluring mountains composed of white sandstone, which reminded me of the quartzite mountains of Killarney on Lake Huron's north shore. Eventually, the rocks I was hiking across gave way to more soil, where tundra grasses, bearberries, and little clumps of dwarf birches reappeared, adding color to the land. As I moved through the birches, flocks of rock ptarmigans would suddenly flutter up from their hiding places. In summer, these ptarmigans have brown plumages to camouflage with their surroundings. In winter, they turn white. All of the ones I startled were white, which I didn't find at all comforting. After I'd hiked about 4 kilometers, I spotted ahead, near where the lake narrowed back into a waterway with a perceptible current, a couple of small plywood cabins. They were perched overlooking a little cove and appeared deserted. As I neared, I saw strewn outside each one considerable rubbish, with empty fuel cans, gasoline jerry cans, plastic bottles, and odd scraps of plywood. The only inhabitants were mice that had torn up the place. Evidently, though, canoeists in the past had stayed in these cabins, as they were dirty and full of garbage, with graffiti on the walls. One comment written in pen noted that the winds were fierce. No kidding, I thought. A little farther along, opposite the cove from these dilapidated cabins, was a third structure made of plywood. I scrambled across some boulders to take a look at this smaller hut. Coming up to it, I noticed a pile of rocks with a crooked, weathered cross sticking out of them. The permafrost makes digging graves difficult, so, traditionally in the Arctic regions of the world, bodies are piled over with rocks. This one had been disturbed, and the skeleton was plainly visible, with lichens growing on its skull. It looked old. The empty eye sockets were left gazing straight up at the sky. Suddenly, I felt a little lonely. I realized my canoe and tent were probably beginning to worry where I'd gone off to, so I decided to turn round and head back. As I retraced my steps, trying not to twist an ankle, I hoped for an evening calm that might allow me to paddle again. Back near my tent, I spotted some little brown birds, Lapland longspurs. They fluttered off, but it felt nice to have some brief company. September 4th dawned with winds that were slightly less fierce. That was all I needed. As fast as I could move, I had my tent down, rolled up, and everything else hauled down to the rocky lake shore. The waves might pick up at any time, so I intended to make a dash for it. Ahead were the closed-in waters of the Thelon's final stretch. If I could get there, I'd be free of the big waters of the lake. My canoe I packed quickly yet carefully, knowing we'd likely be running through waves or rapids before touching dry land again. With my waders on, I pushed the canoe out into the water and then jumped in, paddling hard. The wind gusted, pushing me back towards shore, but I shoved off the shallows and drove on. Strong strokes brought me to where the current became perceptible. I raced along, passing ancient mountains as I went. Several hours of steady paddling carried me down the river's snaking course, through some rapids, then across a wide-open stretch where the winds were fierce. Once I'd crossed this windswept expanse, I could hear the frightening roar of much bigger rapids. I paddled into a rocky cove above them and went ashore. I needed to go ahead on foot and take a good look at what this thundering stretch of river contained. They were the dreaded Alescotoke Rapids, which extend for nearly a kilometer. As far back as the 1920s, they'd been credited with drowning local hunters and trappers. And in more recent decades, when travel by motorboats from Baker Lake had become the norm, even those much larger boats had swamped in them with lives lost. The morning clouds had dissipated, leaving the skies blue and the sun glaring off the torrent of rushing water. Despite my polarized sunglasses, the glare made scouting difficult. It was hard to read the rocks and currents. I could certainly see that these were dangerous rapids, with a stretch of massive waves in their center, perhaps 10 or more feet high. Nevertheless, it seemed that I could safely paddle through them if I stuck close to shore and avoided the violent water in the center. I returned to the canoe and informed it of my decision. I explained that the gouged-up, threadbare hull need only last us through this final rapid, and then another 80 kilometers more of easy paddling, and our journey would be at an end. I'd run more challenging rapids before, but this was the Arctic in September, with steady winds and a bad noonday glare. Still, having come so far, it seemed a shame for things to end badly here, so I left nothing to chance. I fetched my helmet, which I hadn't worn on the journey aside from during the Arctic Turns air raid, and now buckled it up. It was actually an old skateboarding helmet, which I recommend over any other kind of helmet for this sort of thing. With my worn, chipped paddle, I shoved off from shore, paddling a short way toward the sound of thunder. Then, I let the rip-roaring current suck us in. "Here we go," I shouted to the canoe, angling us as I did toward the right shore. The fearsome waves roaring in the center made my palms sweaty, or else that was merely from the thick rawhide winter gloves I was wearing. Some turbulent water smacked the canoe, but I kept us going steady downstream. Then, boom, a rock smashed the canoe's hull on the right while my eyes were foolishly transfixed looking left at the danger in the center, quite oblivious to the swift shallows near shore. This rock tipped my canoe vertically on its side. Cold water splashed in, soaking my right glove that grasped that gunwale to balance it. A centimeter more and I'd be swimming, but I leaned to the opposite side, righting the canoe just in the nick of time. Not for nothing do I practice that kind of balancing stuff on little ponds. The plummet through this long, roaring rapid was like a blur. We flew through more swifts, passing by low cliffs. There was some water in the canoe from my near spill. At least, I thought it was from the near spill. But maybe that rock I'd struck had actually punctured the bottom, a final straw that broke the canoe's hull. If so, then my canoe was actually sinking. I raced ahead, paddling through the remaining rapid, in order to ascertain whether my canoe was in fact taking on water. A half kilometer on, there didn't seem to be any appreciable increase in water levels within the canoe, so I judged it undamaged, relatively speaking. A few hundred meters more and we were through the final stretch of the rapid, leaving its thunder and fury safely behind. I steered into the rocky shore and halted on the bank. There was only one way to tell if my canoe had actually punctured. I emptied all my gear, flipped the vessel over to dump out the water, then repacked everything and set off once more. Paddling along, there didn't seem to be any more water coming in. Finally, I was satisfied that the canoe hadn't punctured. From there, it was easy. I paddled on all day, zooming along on the swift current. On shore, I passed flocks of white snow geese flying over blood-red hills and herds of musk ox beneath rocks as old as time. Elsewhere, caribou grazed on ridges that were brilliant tapestries of white, red, orange, green, and gray. In the distance loomed big and majestic hills. On and on I paddled, knowing but not really believing that my journey was nearly over. By late evening, I paddled down through the last of the Thelon and into the blue immensity of Baker Lake, an inland arm of Hudson Bay that, 3 centuries ago, had been mistaken by explorers for the Northwest Passage. The lake is fresh water, but the occasional seal and even beluga whale swims up into it from Hudson Bay, as well as the odd polar bear, which eats the seals, and hopefully nothing else. 3 years earlier, local hunters from the community of Baker Lake had killed a beluga whale in the lake, and I'd heard stories of wandering polar bears coming near town where they had to be shot. But such things were rare. I pulled into shore on the tundra beyond the river's mouth and made camp for the last time. The town of Baker Lake, population about 2,000, was still another 8 kilometers farther on, but it was getting late. The date was September 4th. It had taken me only 20 days to get here from Sifton Lake. My concerns about being unable to match the pace of the paddlers who'd done that stretch back in the 1970s over 40 days had proven unfounded. Likewise, the more recent speedy duo from the late 1990s, who'd been dropped by a float plane near where my last resupply was and had taken 33 days for their midsummer run to get to this point. I'd relied on some unorthodox methods, wading, hauling, and dragging rather than sitting out the bad winds, making 13-hour days of traveling when conditions dictated. But really, above all, I'd simply tried to be like a tortoise, with the mindset of slow and steady beats the hare. As for my overall route from north of Eagle Plains in the Yukon, I wasn't sure how that stacked up, since no one else had thought to attempt such an unnatural route. But I was getting ahead of myself. The journey wasn't quite over yet, and a lot can happen paddling 8 kilometers alone on an Arctic lake. I reminded myself that the dawn could still bring some crazy weather. A bear could still maul me in the night. A muskox could still plow into the side of my tent. Or lightning could still strike me down. There was still 8 kilometers to go. It was with a strange pang of sadness that I set up my tent on the tundra for the last time. I'd come so far and, despite the hardships, had so loved the journey, the routine, the wildlife, the plants and rocks, the landscapes, the wildness, the glorious skies, even the storms a little, at least when I was warm and snug in some sheltered nook, that a part of me didn't want it to end. No stormy, icy lake I'd ever crossed, roaring massive river I'd pulled up, ice floes I'd pushed on through, or pathless portage over chaotic rocks, seemed half so daunting and demoralizing as the thought of what my email inbox might look like upon my return. I lingered that night, looking over the silent tundra and the glassy lake. It seemed ironic that it should be calm now when I least needed it to be, almost as if nature itself was willing me to stay. A nearly full moon rose above the placid lake, casting an enchanting glow across the water. A good hour I sat there in silence, soaking in the feel and atmosphere of it all. No bear came in the night and ate me. No lightning struck my tent. No storm whipped the lake into an unnavigable frenzy. Not even a muskox bothered to come trample me. Instead, a peaceful night gave way to a tranquil dawn. Still, my heart wouldn't let me leave yet. For so long I'd wanted to get to this point, the end in sight at last, and now I somehow didn't entirely want to get there. For a second or two, well, maybe an hour or two, a mad idea passed through my mind of avoiding that human settlement and going on still farther, down the vastness of the lake and into the salt water of Hudson Bay itself, the very heart of the domain of polar bears. But the gales wouldn't allow it. Winter would be here in weeks and snow and ice would bury everything. But after months alone, you might well ask, didn't I crave real food, a hot meal, a shower, a real bed to sleep in, maybe a couch to watch a movie on, or even to know what had happened in the world since I'd been away? Sure, some part of me did, but the other part didn't. I decided not to paddle into town that day after all, but instead spend one last day and night alone on the tundra, lingering where I'd camped. So I stretched out comfortably on the lichens beside some rocks, writing in my journal and enjoying some tea. I even made a little campfire with some dried-up willows. It wasn't long before a playful Arctic fox came along, staring curiously at me, and then running and dashing around between boulders. This fox still had his summer coat, as if to tell me that winter really wasn't so close after all. Three tundra swans flew overhead, making their trumpet calls as they passed, as if to say goodbye. Some snow geese also flew in close, landing by the shore. An Arctic ground squirrel scurried about among the willows and rocks a few feet away from me. The curious fellow climbed up on a rock, standing on its hind legs to look right at me. The squirrel then chattered cheerfully, as if to speak with me. All the wildlife, it seemed, had come to say goodbye. Even a lone musk ox wandered by on the tundra, though he was nice enough to say goodbye from a distance and not give me a heart attack with a deafening bellow. The following morning, September 6, marked the end. I slowly packed up my camp for the final time, folding everything with more than usual care. My canoe, scarred and gouged but never punctured, I packed quietly on the water's edge. Then I bid goodbye of my own and set off paddling, though not terribly hard. As I paddled over that last stretch, I reflected on how my journey had actually gone remarkably smoothly. I hadn't suffered any injury worth mentioning, just bruises, scrapes, a few lost toenails, and muscle soreness of the kind any contact sports athlete is accustomed to. I'd had no illness of any kind, as untreated water hadn't bothered me at all. I'd never once so much as used my bear spray. My canoe hadn't tipped or swamped, though maybe it came close a few times. I was never really lost or turned around for any significant stretch of time, and I didn't lose a single piece of equipment. I'd completed my journey ahead of schedule, or rather ahead of what I'd been prepared to do if need be, and somehow I even managed to come in slightly under budget. Reflecting on it all like that, I wondered if I'd set the bar too low, and if my adventures would seem merely dull to everyone else. 2 hours later, I crossed the final bay and glided toward a place that loomed on the horizon like a sort of mirage. Concrete and metal buildings, trucks, motorboats, and hovering offshore, a gigantic steel-hulled freighter ship. Beyond the ship towered 8 or 9 enormous steel vats for holding oil or diesel. Float planes were anchored nearby, and a helicopter passed overhead, likely flying to the massive open-pit gold mine that had recently opened north of town and that had brought heavy machinery, transport trucks, regular flights, and hundreds of employees with it. I paddled into shore, gliding into a gravelly beach beneath a hotel and some other modern buildings. It all looked very alien, very strange. I hadn't seen a town since Fort Good Hope nearly 3 months before. It seemed incredibly dense, closed in, and noisy, as transport trucks rumbled through the streets and pickup trucks and four-wheelers raced about. I stood up in the beach canoe, balanced with my paddle off the bottom, looked around, then stepped over my gear and onto dry land. My journey was over. I lingered in town for several days. No one took much notice of me. It was a bustling place, with lots of people from all over coming and going on account of the booming gold mine north of town. I maybe looked a little thinner and more ragged than the average miner, but there was nothing about my beard or long hair to separate me from anyone else. I did take a few hikes outside town with some locals, and even went on a motorboat up the lake some ways. I heard there was talk of opening a uranium mine nearby. My most interesting conversations, however, were with an old-timer I met at the hotel restaurant. If you're curious about what I ate, that was principally just yogurt, which I craved mainly. He was old enough to remember the old days, when Baker Lake had been a trading post and he'd been in the fur trade. He even showed me some black and white photographs from his youth and of some adventures he'd had traveling the land. Chatting with him was like talking with a history book come to life. I asked what he thought of the extraordinary changes that had taken place over his lifetime, and whether he missed the old days at all. He did, it seemed, but he surprised me by saying he hoped to retire to Edmonton, at least for the winters. Conversing with this wise personage reminded me of Betty and her dogs, Winston and Vicky. I wondered how they'd been. She'd asked me to let her know how my journey went, so I figured I'd call her and tell her. With my journey over, for the first time in a long time, I wasn't sure where to go next. I didn't really have a home to go back to. The only place I ever thought of as home was the woods, particularly the ones that surrounded my parents' home. Those were the woods I'd fallen in love with as a child, where I'd first learned about plants, animals, and the wild, the place where I'd slept under the trees nights beyond counting. But that wasn't my home anymore. It hadn't been for years. Since I'd left, I'd drifted, renting temporary places in 7 different towns in as many years, trying to find a place I could feel at home in. My current address was Sudbury, another mining town, and that's where I'd be heading back to, after a stop in Rankin Inlet, then Yellowknife. I wasn't looking forward to the long flights on my way back. I've never much liked flying. It makes me a little nervous. I'm not much of a risk taker. Worse yet, my canoe and I were to be separated, as I couldn't afford to ship it home. It'd be a very sad goodbye. But then the airline people, after hearing of my journey, offered to ship my canoe at no cost to Winnipeg, where, they said, I could make arrangements to retrieve it. And that settled things. 4 months since I'd met Betty and Old Crow, and nearly 4,000 kilometers of trekking and paddling later, my adventures were over. I was headed home, wherever that might be. Ideally, I thought to myself, near a lake somewhere, with some forest and birds and wild animals. Afterward. Nowhere makes you feel as small and insignificant as wandering alone across ancient lava flows that were already a billion years old, before the first dinosaurs ever walked the earth. Nowhere makes you feel so alive as on a pristine lake, the spray of cold water in your face, and an impossible horizon to be reached with your paddle strokes. Nowhere I know conjures up so much enchantment and wonder as an ancient forest, with fragrant spruces and tamaracks, birdsong, and wolves that look you in the eye. There's a kind of magic to these wild places, the kind of thing that can't be captured in words. It's a magic that's becoming rarer in our fast-developing world, which pushes back the wild a little more, year by year, including here in Canada. But it's still there, if you trouble yourself to look for it. You don't necessarily have to wander for months alone in the wild to find it. Look at that great old tree, that field, that bird, that squirrel, and you might just catch a glimpse of it. I think everyone can benefit by becoming a little more attuned to wild places, even if it's just for a day or merely an hour to unplug. I'm asked how I deal with the stress of my journeys, but in reality, that's easy. What's hard is dealing with the stress of a modern, hyper-connected world, traffic, emails, text, social media, 24/7 connectivity, paperwork, asphalt, concrete, noise. That's stressful. But there's a tonic to it. Take a stroll in a nature park, or sit and watch some birds. Or if you really want, try plowing a canoe through ice. If you let it, it will work its magic on you. That's the beauty and charm of nature. It can help us de-stress, rejuvenate, and reawaken our sense of awe. But that's also why it's crucial we find ways to preserve and restore wild places in Canada and beyond, from the vast areas of the north to the very fringes of our sprawling cities and even within them, to the countryside and small towns, and everywhere in between. When we lose these things, we lose something of irreplaceable value and something indispensable to our physical and mental well-being. We lose the biodiversity of the planet, the magic of our world. The solutions to prevent that are pretty much known. It's just a matter of will. And the first part of that is to care enough to want to change things. If this book helps anyone care a little more, or to look upon wild nature with fresh eyes, my journey will have achieved its purpose. This is the author. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Beyond the Trees by Adam Schultz. This program was produced by Sonia Vaillant and directed by Byron Laviolette. Sound engineer, Zach Annette. Text copyright 2019 by Adam Schultz. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House Canada Limited. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.